You're listening to the On Call Nightmares podcast, and every week I go out of my way to get you conversations with technologists that spent time on call. And this week, I'm in Toronto, Canada. I'm outdoors right now and enjoying the Great White North a day before the NBA playoffs. I came here to visit DevOps Days Toronto, got a bunch of great conversations I've already had, did a talk, and this week I've been able to interview Quintessence Onks of Logs.io. Quintessence is someone that I've been able to meet on the DevOps Days touring circuit, if you will. Really, really great person, and I think you're going to enjoy this conversation. If you would like to be on the podcast yourself, it's really easy. Just get in touch with me. To do so, you can send me an email to oncallnightmares@gmail.com, or you can easily just DM me on Twitter. You can use oncallnightmare or jdestro. Either one's fine. So let's go ahead and get into this conversation with Quintessence, which I think you are going to really dig. Really smart person who's doing some really cool stuff right now. So let's get into it, all right? You're listening to the On Call Nightmares podcast, and every week I go out of my way, and that might mean traveling on planes, that might mean going to conferences, but no matter what, I go out of my way to do my best to bring you conversations with technologists who have spent time on call. And today, I've found another one of my road warriors in the world of developer advocacy and relations. It is someone who's worked in the IT community for over 10 years, an infrastructure, DevOps, cloud engineer. This person was a core contributor to the Stark and Wing Shield project. And no, we're not talking about any Batman or anything like that. Completely different. There's no Tony Stark. Cloud Foundry, and currently now Logs.io, a developer advocate and a really great person. Quintessence Onks, how are you today?
I'm doing great. How are you?
I'm good. So we're both here. I've been really lucky to be traveling a lot lately. And in my travels, I try to do these interviews. And so you're someone that I get to see a lot on the road, and I'm always happy to. You know, the upstate New York, West New York, Toronto, we don't hear a lot about it in the rest of IT, so I feel like you kind of hold it down for all of us. You're kind of that representative of Western New York.
I try to be. I love Western New York. It's a beautiful place.
Yes. So you've been in technology for a while now.
Yeah, it like artificially ages you a little bit.
Yeah, it feels that way. You know, I've done 20 years myself. You're in now 10 years. And we'll talk more about the career and where you went and how you got there. But more than anything, in that 10 years, what have you really taken the most, like, give me the big, like, high-level thing. What have you taken the most out of being in tech for 10 years?
It's going to maybe sound a little off, but maybe not so much lately, processes are important. Mm-hmm. Because when you encounter a problem, no one knows what to do, then you have another problem. And the analogy that I've picked up over time for this is, like, let's say you're not particularly familiar with cars in general. Mm-hmm. You go and buy your car, and mm-hmm. they're like, oh, this is how you use the spare tire that we've tucked in your trunk or wherever. This is how you use the kit that's in there to mm-hmm. take care of it, and then you do nothing until you get a flat tire. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's in a month, maybe it's in 10 years, depending on how long you own your car. But by the time you have to change that tire, oh no, I'm so glad I have AAA.
Yeah. Or like the car insurance, as we think about it in the yeah. States. It's like, you know, you're always like, oh my, it costs so much. But, you know, when you get in that car accident, you are sure glad to have it.
Absolutely.
So yeah, I can see how process and procedure can really make you want to grow and be an IT person and really enjoy that world. So I see it. So you've been in 10 years. Mm-hmm. Let's get started with what I like to do in the podcast is tell me how you got really into being an on-call resource early in your career.
It was a bit circuitous, actually, because I was doing IT support for the college campus when I was in college, mm-hmm. continued doing tech support for a few years after that. And then I got a job as a DBA, and thankfully when I was a junior DBA, I wasn't on call, but mm-hmm. shortly thereafter, right, it's when you get your promotion and you yes. say, yay, and then they're like, it's an on-call rotation, and you go, oh no.
Yeah. I remember when that change happened for me. You always get into it with the best of intentions, and then when you realize, oh, what did I do?
Yeah.
It becomes far more evident that you've taken a very, very big bite of a new type of sandwich.
Yes.
And sometimes that sandwich kind of tastes like shit, and there's no other way to put it. So you get your start in school,
mm-hmm.
Like a lot of people in our industry. I feel like whether your major was in like technology or not, a lot of people I feel like starting while they're in school. What was your major?
Physics and mathematics dual major.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
I meet more and more people that, you know, I'm a college dropout, so I mean I own it. But the more I meet more people who are in our industry, especially people who have diverged from the direct engineering roles, they tend to be people who have not spent their entire world in technology. They started somewhere and technology gave them a path to move forward more. Would you say it's that?
I would agree. And especially when I was in school, I had this idea, and for a long time prior to that, when I was a kid, I was like, I'm going to be an astrophysicist. This is amazing.
Mm-hmm.
Landscape was different. I graduated from undergrad right around that massive recession that hit the United States in 2009.
Yes.
So then I was like, oh no. But then I thought, oh, if I stay in technology, since the world is becoming more and more technology based, then rather, instead of competing with, you know, physics and sponsorships and grad and da-da-da,
mm-hmm.
I can just work in technology, and I can do technology that's adjacent to, you know, STEM and research or not.
Mm-hmm.
But it felt more secure to
yeah.
pursue it that way.
I can see that, because in the end, I mean, we still have to pay bills. So that's extremely important, so I understand. So you kind of go into this role. You get the skilled up as
mm-hmm.
you've taken on. You're now more senior within the role, and now you're in an on-call rotation.
Right.
And so how long were you doing that until you, did you eventually move into another rotation at another company, or were you there for a while?
So it's interesting, because my on-call rotation, I was lucky enough that for a fairly significant chunk of my SRE tenure,
mm-hmm.
I was actually working at an ops consultancy. It was Stark & Wayne.
Mm-hmm.
The concept of on-call when you're in a consultancy is very differently, because
sure.
you're hourly. So sometimes,
I've been there.
Sometimes in the contract they're like, oh no, we do need to bill hourly for a consultant to be on call, and sometimes they don't. But the verbiage around that is very different than when you're in-house.
Yes.
Which I was grateful for when I was transitioning between less and more senior roles, because
mm-hmm.
it was, I don't know, on-call light in my personal experience for that. Eternally grateful for that. I got into a pretty heavy duty on-call rotation of like two people at a startup
mm-hmm.
because startup,
yeah.
So that's when it got really intense for a while there.
Cool. So is this still the first job out of college, or are you on more the second job by now?
So I had, that would have been the third job out of college.
Cool. So now your third job out of college. You spent time learning Golang,
yeah.
and then eventually you make your way over to Logs.io.
Yes.
And at Logs.io, you're now working in the DevOps community engagement and helping people really get more out of their data that they're collecting when they produce systems.
Right.
So that's the big idea behind what Logs are doing. But I feel like there's a little bit more to you than just your dev advocate. I know that you really help people who are underrepresented in our industry get more visibility. And I know that you've definitely gone out of your way also for accessibility.
Yes.
So we'll get into that a little bit more. But one
sure.
question I have is, do you think that people who are, say, in roles that demand on-call, do you find that accessibility is hitting them as well through tools like PagerDuty? Like, is PagerDuty really, and VictorOps, are they serving, say, enough for accessibility for their end users? Because we know there are people who do this work.
Mm.
They may be blind, they may be deaf, they may have other things that, do you think that tech, specifically like SRE stuff, we're doing enough to make sure that it's accessible enough for people?
Ooh, that's rough. And it's interesting you mentioned, because a lot of the focus for some of the accessibility is a lot of user accessibility,
mm-hmm.
right? Like, is my product that I'm building for an end user accessible to that end user? But when your end user is another engineer,
mm-hmm.
Like with Logs or PagerDuty or anyone who's producing software for engineers, you really get into an interesting space where the user might be a person who needs disability services, who is still an engineer, though they're not a user in the colloquial sense, right? I see that there's a lot of effort that's done for including that. I would say that it's hard to necessarily do an easy metric as to whether or not, like, when is enough enough, or how can we reach everyone or the majority of everyone. And I think the best way to figure that out or to work on that more is to really, and I know that this comes up a lot, ethics and technology, if we had a review process or something like that. So when we're talking about accessibility and tools, what if the tool is more visual? Like, you know, Logzeo, we focus on ELK, and ELK has Kibana, which is visualizations for data. But if you're blind, that doesn't help you.
Exactly.
If you have a screen reader for logs, depending on how well you're filtering, that might also not help you, because logs can be chatty and verbose, and you'll just have a screen reader reading, like, key value pairs.
Exactly.
And you'll get lost very quickly. So I think that there are things that can be done in the space that can make it more streamlined and more accessible. I don't claim to have all the solutions now, but it's definitely something that we need to think about.
You're bringing the conversations to light, and I appreciate that. So back to the podcast topic little bit. So we're going to bring it back. And I really do thank you for answering that, because one of the things I've been trying to do on this podcast, as well as get people's thoughts around being on call and their stories, is also just like how people look at modern IT operations in general. And like, I like hearing from people like yourself who are a little bit more conscientious of others and are thinking about those. So the only reason I brought up, thank you very much.
Absolutely.
Cool. So we're going to get into a part of the podcast in which I go over the rules. And yes, like a lot of things in life, there are rules. And the rules here are pretty simple. One, we are going to make sure that you don't incriminate yourself, because, you know, that's not what we want to do. We don't want you to get in trouble. We don't want to incriminate anyone else, because we work blamelessly, and this podcast is constantly a retrospective. So the third rule is, let's learn from what you've done. So I'm going to give you the ability to tell me about a really nasty on-call incident and just how you feel like you recovered from it. So please tell me a story.
Sure. So up front, I actually nickname, when I have to tell stories of this nature, I actually developed an umbrella company. It's a shell company that doesn't really exist, and I call it Wild Wild West Systems, 3WS, because, you know, deployment. My favorite on-call story, because it hit so many different points at once, is actually when I was more junior. So I was not the one woken up, and thank goodness for that, because the resulting was a week-long production outage.
Oh, boy.
So it was a bad time.
Yeah, I'd imagine.
It was a bad time. It was early in my career, and it actually happened during the blizzard, because it's Buffalo. And the blizzard had nothing to do with it, but it just ensured that in an office that was actually not geared up for remote work, not only do we have a massive outage, we were doing it remotely as well.
So yeah, like, you know that VPN you're used to? It's not at home yet. Let's get it at home. Things like that. You actually have to get everything. I heard a lot about this when I worked at BuzzFeed during Hurricane Sandy.
Okay.
There was a lot of conversation about how sometimes the biggest problem when you're dealing with a major incident like that.
Yeah.
And you can't get to where everybody normally does the work.
Yep.
Just figuring out how to get to the work.
Right.
So please.
Yeah. So the short version of what ended up happening with that, it actually took a while to figure out. So it hit a few different things, like I said. And the first visible problem was the outage of the data. So when people were trying to run queries on data, you know, things weren't necessarily visible. And then it became a kind of escalation pattern. We're like, oh, wait, this also isn't there. This also isn't there. This what's going on? What's going on? And then, you know, you start sniffing network traffic. And at some point, I, junior, you know, wake up and I'm like, oh no, there are so many messages happening. And I'm skimming through to catch up and pinging the seniors and saying, okay, what's been going on all morning? And as we're checking traffic and everything, we notice that nothing's actually flowing. So, okay, now we've started to identify some sort of, like, central source, right? Oh, the network's not actually routing traffic the way that it should. That's interesting. So then you try and fix that, and then immediately topples on itself. Okay. Digging into the errors of that revealed what looked like a DDoS, but it was internal. And that was odd, right?
Yeah, I mean, if it's a distributed, you know, denial of service attack, you would assume that it'd be from an external, like, an,
right.
It's hitting an externally available endpoint, but it wasn't here.
Right. So it was, traffic was somehow starting to spam out internally, at which point the network switch said to the affected zone, oh no, shut it down. But at the time, again, early in my career, a long time ago, before things like SRE and DevOps and things were common,
mm-hmm.
and HA was a recommendation, it was, we had one zone. So that one zone just collapsed.
The zone just collapsed, sure.
So then we stopped focusing on fixing and bringing up the zone because it was just going to knock down anyway and trying to figure out what was spamming the traffic.
Sure.
So we're going through, and eventually we're going to skip right through to the end. Spoiler alert, there was a hypervisor.
Mm-hmm.
We had, you know, a virtualized system, and in one of the VMs, there was a patch update for Java that for some reason, lost to the annals of time, was causing that VM to spam out traffic and errors.
Mm.
And because of the volume and frequency, it was causing the switch to shut down the traffic and da-da-da-da, and we saw the symptoms that I mentioned before. So this took actually a while to figure out as we're digging around, right?
Switch can't handle the number of packets being transmitted
right.
through it, sure.
So then we fix it, and we're like, hooray, party time, and then everything shuts down again. Oh, no, why? So then we stick everything in read-only mode because we don't actually know why that's just happened. And this is another point that gets hit on in this particular nightmare. The collective living memory of the people currently working in that department had neglected the hot replication that was happening with an off-site server.
Okay.
So we were fixing it, and it was being, quote-unquote, fixed by the other server and undoing our fix, and it led to a few times where we were fixing it and it was going down, fixing it, going down. We were like, why is this still going back down?
So you're having replication be fixed when it's already fixed.
Yes.
I got you. So then the replication keeps trying to take over as like a master over and over
yes.
again. Yeah, that's nuts.
It was a bad week.
So where does the resolution here come? Do they finally make a determination to detach this like live hot spare?
So you detach it and put it into a more passive mode.
Mm-hmm.
You fix one, you fix the other, you bring them both up and reinstantiate the old process, and then everything was fine once more.
And now things are back online.
Yes.
Cool. So you bring everything online, you take this additional, like, was it a database server?
It was actually a replication of the whole setup. So all the VMs and everything. Everything was replicated on this external site.
Oh, so it's trying to do like
the whole thing.
Like what you would call vMotion in VMware, I
yes.
suppose, of moving like instances, if you will, or VMs from one hypervisor to another. Wow, that sucks. wow. That, no wonder you, so I'm guessing that the IPs kept moving in between.
Right, everything kept moving and it made it really hard to navigate. And I remember at the time thinking, this is the career choice I made. I'm so glad I'm a junior right now. I won't be for much longer. Oh, no.
So, you know, I would imagine then you spent a whole bunch of time after the fact kind of
right.
doing some sort of postmortem on it.
Right.
What came from that postmortem?
So the different areas that it hit, right? So now we had this, we needed to document everything better. We needed to document breakages better. We needed to document our own setups better because it really, you know, and this goes to what I said before, processes matter,
mm-hmm.
you know, because they don't matter until they do, right?
Oh, absolutely.
And for basically, it was a small company, but still to have a department of a company go, oh no, we have a whole other piece of equipment, you know, like a few days in. About, right, so we really needed to make sure that we were like, okay, this is our setup, this is how everything's configured, yes, it's not active-passive, it's active-active, how to make it active-passive in the event of a catastrophe,
mm-hmm.
The network switches behavior, splitting into two zones, other such things to make it more protected from itself in the event that something started to go wrong so it didn't take down everything, because realistically what happened was literally one VM out of many took down the whole thing.
And if we know anything about cascading failures, we as an industry,
right.
we talk about how one individual service should never take down an entire set of services. So I feel
right.
like early on, before you really understand that what you were saying before, the SRE methodology,
right.
these were great learning incidents. I mean,
right.
it sucks when it happens,
right.
but you realize how much you learn from these really like wild things. And I feel like personally, I gained a lot from failure.
Oh, yeah.
And I feel like a lot of the people that I talk to nowadays, we keep promoting this idea of, you know, failure is good, you know, break things on purpose. And it's interesting to hear how those concepts kind of came to be. And I really feel that it came from people just accidentally breaking things.
Yeah.
And, you know, Nathan and Harvey and I talked about this last week. But you really kind of feel like you become part of a company when you take down their production services. And well, it's odd because I've done that at a couple places. And, like, it's I guess, about dealing with the aftermath. And I guess that's what we're talking about, the aftermath.
Right.
And what was learned. So in my cases of, like, taking down tons of systems or a service or something and things don't work, you know, you sit, you talk with people, and you find out why exactly this problem happened. Were you all able to kind of come to that kind of resolution?
We were. And again, it had to do with, and it, you know, more things that went in. I'm sure a million of us, not just our company, not 3WS, as it mm-hmm. were, but, you know, a million of us is what went into things like Google's SRE, right?
Sure.
Because when we discovered it, it's not like someone just pushed that patch into production and thought, cool beans. We did have separate dev and staging, and that's when we noticed that not everything was in sync version-wise.
Mm-hmm.
So the patch update didn't apply the same way. It didn't have the same behavior in the different environments, which again, I mean, yes, de facto, it's obvious that your environments need to be in sync for you to be able to legitimately test behavior. It's not like they fell out of sync on purpose,
mm-hmm.
but then you develop processes to make sure that they don't fall out of sync again.
Yes.
And like I said, this particular outage just touched on multiple things at once, right?
Yeah, and the thing that you really learn about after the fact in these incidents, and it's funny because I talked about it in my talk today, was that when these types of things happen, you know, they continue by nobody having conversations afterwards.
Ooh, yeah.
Yeah, and we tend to, like, acquire more technical debt because, you know, the after a major incident, people don't sit down and involve other teams.
Right.
They don't necessarily recognize that a bigger look at what happened and how to prevent it in the future is needed to be done. And so I really believe in the open postmortem. I feel like the right amount of people is who should be there. And you need to ask yourself that as a company. Who needs to know what happened and how can we work, not just the engineering team, but other portions of the company. How do we work to ensure that this doesn't happen again and that the people that need to be, you know, informed are informed, whether it's our customers or our engineers internally.
Right. Absolutely.
So let's start bringing it home, which is what I do at this podcast, and we start rolling. And I want to talk to you before we kind of wrap. I want to ask you a question I ask everybody. And if you could give a piece of advice to anyone that's currently on call, what do you think it would be?
Make sure you have adequate support. And make sure that you know who to escalate through or to or with, mm-hmm. depending on, you know, your personal status in the tool chain of humans. Because if you don't know where to take a problem, if it exceeds your time, tiredness, anything,
mm-hmm.
then you're going to get stuck hamster wheeling and you're not going to move that wheel out of the mud.
That's really good advice. So let's talk a little bit about you and now and what you're doing.
Sure.
So Logs.io, it's kind of an Elk stack powered way to review inbound data that's acquired from logging and other portions. Let me ask you, you're in a really crowded kind of place right now in the world. There's a lot of people that want to help represent your logging data somehow, another visualization.
Yeah.
What's the thing that you feel like Logs is stand out and you're like, this is why I'm glad I'm doing this?
So it's interesting you asked that because I was actually a customer before I was in Flea.
Well, that's cool.
And one of the things that I liked as a customer, I actually really liked, and I cannot understate this enough, that it was really nice to have a hosted Elk
mm-hmm.
and not have to, you know, handle that myself in addition to other tasks I was doing at the time.
Sure.
I did enjoy that you can actually separate things out into separate accounts very quickly and mm-hmm. easily, so that, for example, if I want my dev data to not last as long as my production data, I can do that.
Sure.
I also...
TTLs based on use case, if you will?
Basically.
Cool.
You can separate that out however logically makes sense for whatever your application is, but right? And I actually also really liked the fact that we have, since I've been onboarded, now we're doing all these things with security. So we actually built a security product on top of the Elk Stack, and we actually have some built in so that people don't have to build that all from scratch from our research and our security team.
Awesome.
Yeah.
And what else are you like personally working on? I know you always have a bunch of different little projects, and you're always kind of like mentoring and fostering people into technology.
Right.
So what are you up to lately?
So we actually instantiated Inclusive Tech Buffalo within the past calendar year. And that was basically a shift and a rebrand from an organization that we had been working with prior. And basically, we're continuing the same mission, but expanding our scope.
Mm-hmm.
And it's to what you said about the mentoring and just fostering and getting these people into technology. Because I think especially when you see a vision of success that is maybe passively portrayed as a singular thing, oh, well, I didn't major in computer science, mm-hmm. or I'm too old, or I'm too young, or whatever is self-deprecating and stopping you, if you have a conversation, you can realize there are lots of people who didn't major in CS or who are older or who mm-hmm. are younger or just have some sort of what may be a non-traditional path, but a conversation may be more traditional than you initially realize.
And I think when people hear that you're not the only one, right. or there's someone else who's doing this and has come from the same path you did,
right.
it gives them far more interest, just interest. Just knowing that, you know, you're not the first person and you probably won't be the last person to go from a non-traditional background into technology. And so I think you're helping people kind of get through that. And I appreciate it because I think that we need people that have different types of viewpoints or the way the world kind of looks to them through how they were educated.
Right.
Whether it's, you know, I was a sociology major, mm-hmm. and now I have a better way to interpret data because I think about biases.
Yeah.
Things like that, I think it makes it important, and it's changing how
yeah.
our side of the business really works.
Right, and I actually do a brief intro to that from one of the talks that I give, the Serendipity talk, because mm-hmm. that's about diversity and about how you don't necessarily hire on these criteria,
mm-hmm.
but if you're more diverse, you get them.
Exactly.
For free.
Mm-hmm. It's like just being able to recognize that in a business, a singular group that's, you know, homogenous is going to probably give you one vision
yeah.
most of the time. And I feel that technology requires multiple views on how something could be done and how it will help different people. And like we talked about in the beginning, you know, it's a silly story. I'll tell it really quickly. I was in Amsterdam and I watched a commercial for an egg that you can boil without a shell. You can make a hard-boiled egg without the shell. You just crack an egg and you put it into this okay. thing and then you boil it. And at first I thought, wow, this is really silly.
Yeah.
And then I started thinking about it and I said, wow, what if you actually don't have hands, fingers, or you have arthritis or some other debilitating way and you've always wanted a hard-boiled egg? Someone thought about that. And
mm-hmm.
so there are things related to technology, I think,
yeah.
that if we start thinking about, like, who doesn't have access and how do we get it to them, I think is my little hard-boiled egg. And so that's the way I'm thinking about stuff lately. Anyway, Quinn, thank you so much for time here today.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
No problem. How can everybody follow you and find you and all those things so they can keep up with what you're up to?
I'm mostly on Twitter, and my Twitter handle is just my name, Quintessence Anx, last
mm-hmm.
name A-N-X. And then I'm also on Notice, which is where I keep a copy of my presentations and any videos that conferences post. And my username there is just Quintessence.
Cool. I'll make sure that everybody gets those links in the show notes. So we're going to wrap this up. Thank you very much, Quinn. And we are, like I said, here at DevOps Days Toronto. This first day is almost over, and we're going to move into the second day. Quinn's going to be talking. It's going to be great. If you've never been to a DevOps Days, you will probably see one of us if you go. So, you know, come on down. We're a great group, and we want to have you part of this. So thanks, Quinn. We'll be right back with On-Call Nightmares. Well, that's the podcast for this week. Thanks a lot for listening. I'm really enjoying myself out here in Toronto. It's beautiful, and I want to recommend you take a look at this DevOps Days Toronto in the future. They're doing such a great job. There's so many people here. It's really, really impressive. So
Thanks a lot to the organizers here for having me. And for everyone else, if you'd like to be on a future episode, I think you know how, but I'll tell you once more. Send an email to oncallnightmares@gmail.com or send me a tweet, a DM, whatever you want, @oncallnightmare or @jdestro. We'll catch you next time with the next episode of On Call Nightmares, where every week I go out of my way to do my best to make sure that I bring you conversations with technologists who've spent time on call. See you next time.